Chapter 1. Hades. John T. Unger came from a family that had been well known in Hades, a small town on the Mississippi River, for several decades. The family was often seen around town, and they were known for their many accomplishments and contributions to city life. John's father had won the amateur golf championship again and again, despite tough competition. Mrs. Unger was known for her political speeches. And young John T. Unger, who had just turned 16, had danced all the latest dances from New York while he was still just a boy. And now, for a few years, he was going to be away from home. His parents were gripped by the desire to send him to get an education in New England. Like many well-off families from small towns, they saw great things ahead for their children and wanted to give them the same opportunities as wealthy children from big cities. They were set on sending him to the respected St. Midas's School near Boston. Hades was too small and provincial to hold their darling gifted son. Now in Hades, the names of the more fashionable preparatory schools and colleges mean very little. The inhabitants have been removed from the world of big cities and high fashion for so long that, though they make a show of keeping up to date in fashion, manners, and literature, their tastes are a little bit out of date, and people from big cities would look down on them. An event that in Hades would be considered fancy would probably be described by a wealthy person from Chicago as perhaps a little tacky. Before he left, John T. Unger's mother lovingly packed his trunks full of linen suits, and Mr. Unger presented his son with a wallet full of money. "Remember, you are always welcome here," he said. "You can be sure, boy, that we'll keep the fire burning at home for you."
"I know," answered John with tears in his eyes.
"Don't forget who you are and where you come from," continued his father proudly, "and no harm can come to you. You are an Unger, from Hades."
So the old man and the young shook hands, and John walked away with tears streaming from his eyes. 10 minutes later, he passed the city limits and stopped to glance back for the last time. Over the gates, the old-fashioned town looked strangely beautiful to him. His father had been trying for years to modernize the town, but no one had ever really listened. Now, looking back at it, John knew that he would miss many things about it. John set his face ahead with a determined look. As he turned away, the lights of Hades against the sky seemed full of a warm and passionate beauty. St. Midas's was half an hour from Boston in an expensive car, but unfortunately for John T. Unger, he did not have one, so he walked there. No one except John had ever arrived there on foot, and probably no one ever will again. St. Midas's was the most expensive and exclusive boys' preparatory school in the world. John's first 2 years there passed pleasantly. The fathers of all the boys were extremely wealthy, and John spent his summer visiting at fashionable summer houses. While he liked all the boys he visited, their fathers all seemed exactly the same. When he told them where his home was, they would ask jovially, "Pretty hot down there?" And John would force a weak smile and answer, "It certainly is." He wouldn't have minded so much if they had not all made this same joke in various forms, like, "Is it hot enough for you down there?" which he hated just as much. In the middle of his second year at school, a quiet, handsome boy named Percy Washington was put in John's class. He was pleasant and extremely well-dressed, even for St. Midas's, but for some reason, he stayed away from the other boys. The only person with whom he was close was John T. Unger, but even to John, he never talked about his home or his family. That he was wealthy went without saying, but beyond the few things Percy said about himself, John knew little of his friend. When Percy invited him to spend the summer at his home in the West, John accepted without hesitation, eager to find out more about him. It was only when they were in the train that Percy became, for the first time, fairly communicative. One day, while they were eating lunch in the dining car and discussing the imperfect characters of several of the boys at school, Percy changed his tone and made a sudden remark. "My father," he said, "is by far the richest man in the world." "Oh," said John politely. He could not think of an answer to make to this statement. He considered, "That's very nice," but it sounded wrong, and he was about to say, "Really?" but stopped himself since it would seem to question Percy's statement, and a polite young man like John could not question such a statement. "By far the richest," repeated Percy. "I was reading in the world record book," began John, "that there was one man in America with an income of over $5 million a year, and four men with incomes of over $3 million a year, and..." "Oh, they're nothing." Percy's mouth was a half moon of scorn. "Small stuff. My father could buy them out and not know the difference." "But how does he..." "Why isn't he in the record book?" "Because he doesn't report his income. He reports a little, but not his real income." "He must be very rich," said John simply. "I'm glad. I like very rich people. The richer a man is, the better I like him." There was a look of passionate honesty on his face. "Last Easter, I visited the Schlitzer Murphys. Vivian Schlitzer Murphy had jewels as big as hen's eggs." "I love jewels," agreed Percy with enthusiasm. "Of course, I wouldn't want anyone at school to know about it, but I've got quite a collection myself. I used to collect them instead of stamps." "And diamonds," continued John eagerly. "The Schlitzer Murphys had diamonds as big as strawberries." "That's nothing." Percy had leaned forward and dropped his voice to a low whisper. "That's nothing at all. My father has a diamond bigger than the Ritz-Carlton Hotel." As the boys traveled west, the land around them became flat, and their train was like a tiny speck of dust on the massive plain. Far ahead of them, the Montana sunset lay between two mountains like a massive fire with flames spreading across a vast sky. This is where the boys were going. Under the high sky, and in the shadows of the mountains, lay the village of Fish, tiny, poor, and forgotten. There were 12 men in the village of Fish, 12 dark and strange souls who scraped out their living from the bare rock. They had become a race apart, these 12 men of Fish, like a species accidentally developed by nature, which had abandoned them to struggle against death. Out of the blue-black sky in the distance, a long line of moving lights crept over the bare flat land, and the 12 men of Fish gathered like ghosts to watch the passing of the 7 o'clock train, the Transcontinental Express from Chicago. 6 times a year, the Transcontinental Express stopped at the village of Fish, and a passenger would step out, get into a horse-drawn cart that appeared from out of the dark, and drive off into the sunset. Watching this rare event had become a sort of strange ceremony for the lonely men of Fish. They observed, that was all. They had been abandoned in the hard wild for so long that they did not even try to make sense of the coming of the train. For them, it was an event that could not be explained, a miracle. If the men of Fish had been capable of holding a religion, the event would have been sacred. But they were so wild that no religion was able to take hold in their strange ghostly town. So all they did was watch with empty eyes. On this June night, 2 minutes after 7 o'clock, Percy Washington and John T. Unger stepped off the train, hurried past the fascinated empty eyes of the 12 men of Fish, got into a cart which had appeared out of nowhere, and drove away.